Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with Nancy Pelosi's remark that yesterday Attorney General Barr committed a crime lying to Congress, and today Barr did not show up before the House Judiciary Committee, prompting another likely subpoena for contempt after he missed the deadline on a previous subpoena to hand over the full unredacted Mueller report to Congress. Lawrence Douglas, a professor of law, jurisprudence, and social thought at Amherst College, joins us to discuss the difficult path ahead for the Democrats to get the public to understand what is actually in the Mueller report and how much it calls into question Trump's legitimacy and fitness to be president. Barr and the Republicans have apparently succeeded in muddying the waters to the point that a lot of Americans think the report was no big deal and there should be no more investigations of Trump. But had Mueller been able to get his report to the Congress without it being intercepted and distorted by Barr, we would be in a very different situation today, with the public demanding further investigations into the report's findings. And although Barr's reputation may be tarnished in the eyes of many, he might well be rewarded for his service to Trump with a nomination to the Supreme Court if a vacancy arises, and, like Kavanaugh, in spite of objections from Democrats, be confirmed by the Republican majority in the Senate. Then we'll examine the embarrassing amateurism of the Trump foreign policy team as they blindly bluster their way into making the crisis in Venezuela worse and a transition to economic revival and democratic rule less likely. Michael Shifter, the president for policy and director of the Andean Program at the Inter-American Dialogue and co-editor of Constructing Democratic Governance in Latin America, joins us to discuss how the Trump, Pence, Pompeo, Bolton, Abrams militaristic approach mixed with wishful thinking is making Maduro look good and the U.S. look like a blundering bully. Then finally, with the abdication of Japan's Emperor Akihito and the ascension of his son Emperor Naruhito to the throne, we'll assess how much Japan is drifting away from America's nuclear umbrella as the U.S.'s post-war alliances fray under Trump and China continues its rise as a regional and global power. Graham Fuller, the former vice chairman of the National Intelligence Council at the CIA, joins us to discuss the growing possibility that in the not-too-distant future, Japan will join the nuclear club. And before we begin today's program, I want to thank listeners like you who are helping us build a new home online at backgroundbriefing.org. We encourage you to bookmark our new website and join the community of listeners we are building nationwide with your support at backgroundbriefing.org/donate to keep us independent and free from corporate sponsors so that we can continue to provide breaking news analysis from the most knowledgeable guests we can find as we build a reality-based community in post-truth America. And joining us now is Lawrence Douglas, a professor of law, jurisprudence, and social thought at Amherst College. His books include The Memory of Judgment, The Right Wrong Man, and A Jurisprudence of Atrocity. Welcome to Background Briefing, Lawrence Douglas.
Always a pleasure to be with you, Ian.
Well, thank you, Lawrence. And there's been quite an extraordinary event took place, of course, yesterday before the Senate Judiciary Committee, and today the Attorney General William Barr was supposed to appear before the House Judiciary Committee. I don't know whether it was too much for him to do 2 days in a row being beaten up, and quite justifiably, because his performance has been all along absolutely unbelievable. Because I don't know, why did people think that this guy was somehow going to be a real attorney general in the sense he'd be the upholding the law for the American people as opposed to being Trump's lawyer? We know Whitaker was a total disgrace, and we know that Jeff Sessions, Trump tried to fire him because he wasn't his Roy Cohn. But it's so obvious. The guy auditions for the job, and he has done an amazingly successful job in blunting the impact of the Mueller report. And he continues to do so in his stonewalling, and now, of course, he's stiffed the House. So I guess it's a long-winded way to ask you, why did anybody fall for Bill Barr in the first place?
Well, I think one of the points that you make is a very important one, which is a lot of people have been focusing, obviously, on the letter, the four-page summary that he issued on March 24th, showing how that really was a distortion of the Mueller report. But I think the more critical document from Bill Barr, is the memo that he wrote in June 8, 2018, where he was basically auditioning for the job of Attorney General. And I don't think enough people have really kind of focused on that memo. For one thing, it's quite long. It's about 18 single-space pages long. But in that memo, he makes it very, very clear that he vehemently disagrees with the whole legal theory behind the Mueller investigation. I mean, he says on the very first page of that memo, Mueller's obstruction theory is fatally misconceived. And if anyone had read that, they wouldn't have been at all surprised to see that he was going to do everything possible to tank the results of the Mueller investigation. And that's precisely what he's done. And he's done it in a, you know, pretty effective way. Because once you control a narrative, once you control the spin, you really control how the public is going to perceive it. And by basically issuing his four-page summary on March 24th and then waiting a full 3 weeks to release the redacted report, he was basically able to spin the document and to control the narrative in a very, very effective fashion.
And he's still doing it because the House Judiciary Committee have subpoenaed the full document, unredacted, and Barr is giving them the back of his hand,
Exactly. He both failed to ignore the subpoena for the deadline for the unredacted report, and obviously he also failed to show up for the House Judiciary Committee today. So we had that very nice middle picture of, you know, the empty seat with William Barr's name on the name tag in front of the empty table.
Well, I have been told some stuff which I haven't been able to get anybody go on the record, unfortunately, because of jeopardy to their positions. But my understanding is that about a month before the memo, the summary, Mueller went to Barr and said, look, I want to indict the president on obstruction of justice. And Barr, of course, said no way, et cetera. And then they got into a negotiation, and then at one point, Mueller was prepared to go ahead and indict him, knowing that under the DOJ's rules, where you can't indict a sitting president, it also says if the attorney general turns down an indictment, all that material and the underlying documentation has to be sent to the chairs right. of the House and Senate Judiciary Committees. And that was a way to do an end run around Barr. So the long and the short it is that there's been apparently negotiations going on behind the scenes all along where Barr has essentially worn down Mueller. And I don't know what the nature of their friendship was before and certainly after, but it seems to me that this letter that's just been surfaced is sort of further proof that, one, they've been negotiating, and two, that basically Mueller's been on the defensive, that Barr's been running rings around him.
You know, I'm not really in a position to comment on that because I'm not sure, you know, I can't, and when I say I can't confirm or deny
Well, neither can I.
So it's hard for me to comment on it. You know, it would, to be honest, surprise me a little bit because it does seem like Mueller all along had subscribed to this DOJ understanding that you can't indict a sitting president. So I might be a little bit surprised to hear that he really was keen on issuing an indictment on obstruction of justice. But still, that kind of, even if my take is the correct, it really doesn't undercut what Barr has done. Because really, if you understand what Barr wrote in his memo, there is basically nothing that Mueller could have demonstrated that, to Barr's mind, would have constituted obstruction of justice. The only thing in the memo, according to Barr, is if you can prove that the president had destroyed evidence. That would be one thing. But if the president goes ahead and fires, if the president had gone ahead and fired Mueller, would that have constituted obstruction of justice according to William Barr? The answer is no, according to his memo. So he has a very, very lenient, a very, very expansive notion of executive powers. And basically nothing that Mueller demonstrated in his report was going to convince Barr that it constituted obstruction of justice. And so he's now just been going off on his way to basically kind of cover the president.
Well, I think the impression I got from what I was told was going on behind the scenes was that Mueller felt there was enough to indict him on obstruction of justice, whether or not you try to get around the DOJ rules. Mm-hmm. The point being that Barr wore him down, and they decided not to. That's why it was equivocal. On the one hand, he said that he wasn't going to indict him, but on the other hand, he said he wasn't going to exonerate him. And that, what I'm suggesting here is that that was Barr's work. That was his mission, and he succeeded.
Yeah, I'm just not sure. Again, it could be right. I'd be really surprised if William Barr could wear down Bob Mueller. Mueller seems like a pretty tough cookie, and I'd be surprised if he could do it. And again, one of the things that I think is very clear from the way Mueller characterized the obstruction charge is I think he made it basically clear that if this were anyone other than the President of the United States, who happens to have this kind of special immunity while serving in office, any other American would be charged with obstruction. And the only reason that they're not recommending the charge is simply because it would be kind of legally void. There would be no way, there would be nothing to do with it, at least while he is he's a sitting president. Of course, it leaves open the possibility of charging him with obstruction once he's left office. But I always like being surprised, but I would be surprised to hear that Barr was able to wear down Mueller.
And again, I'm speaking with Lawrence Douglas, Professor of Law, Jurisprudence and Social Thought at Amherst College. His books include The Memory of Judgment, The Right Wrong Man, and A Jurisprudence of Atrocity. No, I didn't mean to take you off track here because, it's somewhat speculative, but the big issue here is that Barr basically intercepted the report and blunted its impact and spun it in a way that was favorable to the president. And this is where I think the rubber meets the road, as they say. Recent polls indicate that a growing majority of Americans, it's up from I think about 36% now to 44%, just don't want any more investigations. Now, what they don't know is what's in the Mueller report. You can credit Barr and the Republicans with that. They have literally done an extraordinary job of muddying the waters to the point where the average American doesn't simply know what's in that report and how damaging it is to Trump and how you could pick up the threads and the evidence that Mueller has presented and go ahead and impeach Trump. So that's what's really going on here, surely, that they have done an amazing job of blunting it. And now the political choice for the Democrats is, you know, I think the impeachment train has left the station. On the other hand, maybe Trump wants to be impeached. Maybe this is a way to stir up his base. That's the fear that Pelosi has had all along, that we're going to hand Trump a gift by impeaching him.
I think that's exactly right. I think it's a little bit of like that that old Clint Eastwood line from that old movie about like "Make My Day."
I mean, yeah, go ahead and make my day.
Trump's attitude about impeachment. I mean, I think it would be something that would be incredibly galvanizing to his base, and it puts the Democrats in kind of an exceptionally difficult position. And it's a little bit like any time you have a sort of populist demagogue along the lines of like a Trump. It puts people in an exceptionally difficult position because regardless, I mean, even, bracketing the question of whether he committed criminal acts, and it does seem like he did commit the criminal act of obstruction of justice, the whole way in which he's tried to interfere with the investigation, in fact, it's all a piece with Barr's spinning of the report. It demonstrates a kind of a corruption of public office. Again, if not criminal corruption, then again, simply a corruption of the kind of ethical standings that we demand of leaders. And that certainly is an impeachable offense. And it's sort of kind of sad that the question about whether to impeach or not turns not on the question of the fitness for office, but about the optics of impeachment and whether it will kind of simply backfire in the Democrats' face. So it really turns into kind of a tactical decision rather than a real kind of moral decision.
Well, but if we were to assume, for example, that if Barr hadn't done what he did and if Mueller had been able to release the report the way he wanted to do, according to the letter that he wrote to Barr, complaining about the way Barr's memo had spun it, had he wanted to, either release the the summaries first and then the whole report, at least with the redactions, second, and then eventually the whole report. That seems to be, I think it's fair to say that that's probably the way that Mueller would have done it had he been able to. And I think had that happened, we'd be having a very different conversation today, don't you think?
I agree completely. Absolutely. I mean, you could certainly say that that Barr kind of saved the president's bacon. I mean, it seems very clear that even after Mueller wrote the letter from March 27th objecting to Barr's four-page summary, you know, at that point in the 27th letter, he said, well, look, you're kind of distorting and mischaracterizing our findings. We want you right now to publish these executive summaries of our findings. And even then, Barr just kind of sits on the report for another 3 weeks, basically, and doesn't comply with Mueller's request. And by that time, as we've been saying, the spin doctors were already, the Republican spin doctors were already in control of the narrative. So I think you're absolutely right. We'd be in a very different kind of political universe right now had Mueller been able to roll out his report in the manner that he presumably hoped to do.
So what can be done now, given that the Democrats are being painted into a corner, they're on the defensive, the American people don't know the severity of what's actually in the report, both on the Russian story, by the way, and on the obstruction of justice on Volumes 1 and Volumes 2. They're both incredibly incriminating. But again, the waters have been muddied and people don't have a clear picture of how what kind of a president they have and how much legal jeopardy he's in. And if he were a regular civilian, he'd be in jail by now. So that, how do you get to that point? How do you undo the damage that Barr has done on behalf of Trump?
I'm not sure how I know the answer to that question. And I think one of the things that you pointed out in the question, which is incredibly important, is one of the consequences of Barr's spin of the report is how we've also lost sight of the, you know, very, very disturbing proof that has been supplied of the Russian tampering with our election and the very real possibility that they're going to try to do the identical thing in 2020, and that there's no political will, there's no political preparedness on the part of the administration to do anything about that. And that's also kind of incredibly potentially damaging thing to the health of our democracy.
Well, we know that Lindsey Graham and the Republicans are going to start holding hearings about Hillary Clinton's emails.
Yeah,
they're going to go
scandal.
Full on Benghazi for the next several months to change the subject. So, again, it's not just that the waters have already been muddied, that the Republicans are going to continue with this campaign of distraction. So it's really hard to figure out how to get this thing refocused in a way that will get the attention of the American people.
Precisely. In fact, not only will they be focusing on Hillary Clinton's emails in Benghazi, but they're actually going to focus on the Mueller investigation itself.
Right, to investigate the investigators.
Going to investigate the investigators. And, you know, this at one point very early on seemed like a scandalous defamation of the Mueller investigation team by the president as a witch hunt now is being picked up and being kind of given its own legs to move forward.
Well, one of the things that I learned about Barr was that he's a Federalist Society zealot along with, and he's a friend of Leonard Leo's, the head of the Federalist Societies. And one of the speculations was that, well, you know, like a lot of these guys in the older Republican establishment, they don't like Trump, but on the other hand, they love the fact that he'll rubber stamp any judge that Leonard Leo sticks in front of him on a list. And he's already got two on the court and they're hoping for a third. They really have their fingers crossed that Ruth Bader Ginsburg is going to retire or have to retire. I don't even want to think about it, but that's apparently, they're kind of relishing that prospect. So the latest rumor I've heard is that Barr actually would like to be on that list. He would like to be considered for
elevation to the Supreme Court.
Exactly, and that not only did he audition for this job, now that he's performed this job for Trump, that's an audition for the Supreme Court.
Yes, that's right. Exactly. This is just this was not the end game at all. This was the first step. And I think, yes, and I think that's right. I think one of the things that many of the conservative Republicans who, behind the scenes hold their nose anytime the name Trump gets mentioned, you know, they've kind of engaged in this sort of this Faustian bargain that as long as this guy is going to populate the federal judiciary with our peeps, then he's our man, so long as he can do that. And especially if that could lead to a third pick. I mean, obviously we're talking about the district court level, the circuit court of appeals level, and of course the biggest prize is the Supreme Court itself. And that's why I think a lot of people are probably sending in their checks to the Ruth Bader Ginsburg to, health fund or so to keep her,
right,
you know, alive and kicking.
Well, from your lips to God's ears. And
exactly.
I thank you for joining us, Lawrence Douglas.
Always a pleasure, Ian.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Lawrence Douglas, Professor of Law, Jurisprudence, and Social Thought at Amherst College. His books include The Memory of Judgment, The Right Wrong Man, and A Jurisprudence of Atrocity. We're going to take a brief station break and back examining the embarrassing amateurism of the Trump foreign policy team as they blindly bluster their way into making the crisis in Venezuela worse. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Michael Shifter, who is the President for Policy and Director of the Andean Program at the Inter-American Dialogue, and is the co-editor, along with Jorge Dominguez, of Constructing Democratic Governance in Latin America. He also writes and comments widely on U.S.-Latin American relations and hemispheric affairs, and has regularly testified before Congress about U.S. policy towards Latin America. Welcome to Background Briefing, Michael Shifter.
Thank you. Thanks for the invitation.
So in your long experience, have you ever seen, we know that the U.S. has had some rocky relationships, to put it mildly, with Central and South America over the decades, but at least they seem to be operating, even if the policies were bad, at least they seem to have some grasp of reality. What is happening with the top national security people in our government vis-a-vis Venezuela? It doesn't seem like they're talking to the right people. It doesn't seem that they have proper intelligence about what's actually happening on the ground. The idea that on Tuesday, the National Security Advisor John Bolton would go public and say that Venezuela's Defense Minister Vladimir Padrino, along with the head of the Supreme Court and the commander of the Presidential Guard, had said that Maduro has to leave power, and hinted in no uncertain manner that they were in negotiation with Guaido. And then we find today that Padrino, the defense minister, is standing next to Maduro as he celebrates with the military that he's in charge. So this is beyond embarrassing.
Well, I agree. It's mystifying. And when I heard that Bolton statement, it was hard to believe. And it, actually, Padrino came out right after Bolton's statement that he fully supported Maduro, that he backed Maduro. So it's hard to know what's going on here, hard to know whether this is some sort of psychological warfare game. And it's just, again, as I said, it's mystifying and certainly just not helpful. If anything, it's at precisely the time when their attention is focused on trying to push towards a democratic transition, this kind of rhetoric and remarks only hardens the position of Maduro and makes him dig in even further. And of course, the senior leadership becomes more distrustful of the United States. So this is taking us back, not moving us forward. And I think it's unfortunate.
So, and this came a day after Pompeo had said on CNN, one, that military action was still possible, something that he has repeated since. But he also said that Maduro was about to leave for Cuba, but the Russians talked him out of it. So on top of what Bolton said that turned out to be completely inaccurate and makes you wonder whether these people, our top leadership, are being played by the Venezuelans, the Russians, of course, dismissed it out of hand. What do you know about that? Was there any more substance?
I haven't seen any substantiation of what Pompeo said. No one has. There hasn't been any other evidence. It's been reported wildly by the press, but the press hasn't been able to get any confirmation of it. Obviously, Maduro flatly denied it. The Russians denied it. You know, it seems to me that Pompeo may be putting, you know, Venezuela in the framework of U.S.-Russian relations where it doesn't belong, and it should be a focus on Venezuela. Not on Cuba, not on Russia, not on China, but Venezuela and what to do. And unfortunately, this sometimes happens that Venezuela gets inserted either into global politics or U.S. domestic politics. And it strikes me that those remarks kind of suggest that's the way it's being treated, which is not the recipe for solving the crisis, which is Venezuela.
Well, is that to suggest then that there's another player in this, the gang that couldn't shoot straight at the top levels of our foreign policy elite, that is Senator Marco Rubio? He's supposed to be driving the policy, and he's supposed to have Trump's ear. And we know that Trump doesn't really pay much attention to foreign policy or to facts, for that matter. So is this amateurism? Is that... Could you lay some of that at Marco Rubio's feet? Because he comes from that group down there.
Yeah, I mean, this is all, I think it has to be understood in the context of U.S.-Cuban policy and the enormous frustration and disappointment that the regime in Cuba has been there for six decades, and despite every effort by part of the United States, including an embargo, which is still on, has been unsuccessful. This is seen as the Venezuela opening, and especially the emergence of Guaido and an opposition that finally has a leader and finally is united, should be seen in the context of, you know, of an opportunity to move towards Cuba. And the administration has announced very punishing additional sanctions against Cuba, believing that somehow this would force the Cuban government or lead the Cuban government to stop supporting Maduro. And you know, it's like we haven't learned anything after six decades, that this kind of pressure tactics and threats simply don't work. It's not that they may be okay in principle if they work, but they don't work, and we know that. And so it's a matter of just confronting the reality of the bad results that the U.S. has had for so long, and then going back insisting on these same failed policies. So it really makes you wonder. And clearly, there's a very strong ideological agenda and a desire to project toughness by part of this administration. And Senator Rubio's rhetoric has been, you know, directly aimed at the Venezuelan generals and telling them they must turn on Maduro and move to Guaido. And, you know, that simply, you know, makes the generals dig in even more and has exactly the opposite effect of what Senator Rubio presumably intends to have. And the generals are not going to react to pressure from a foreign power, especially the United States. And that seems to be a lesson that is very clear in U.S.-Latin American relations, but that seems to be lost on the team that's working on Venezuela. And they're going back to an old style that simply was unsuccessful and I'm sure will be equally fruitless in this situation.
And again, I'm speaking with Michael Shifter, who's the President for Policy and Director of the Andean Program at the Inter-American Dialogue and is co-editor, along with Jorge Dominguez, of Constructing Democratic Governance in Latin America. He also writes and comments widely on U.S.-Latin American relations and hemispheric affairs and has regularly testified before Congress about U.S. policy towards Latin America. So is it to say then that people like Senator Rubio, who come out of the Cuban, anti-Cuban group down there in Florida, which of course do have a lot of support. I believe they still actually, television Martí and radio Martí still broadcast every day, even though they're jammed and nobody in Cuba watches them, and yet the taxpayer spends a lot of money for these people to show up every day and actually make news reports. There's something sort of surreal and almost comical about that. So the question would be then, are we dealing with people who are delusional, or, to be more kind, guilty of wishful thinking?
I think there's a lot of wishful thinking in this scenario. I mean, I'm just struck. I've been in Washington a long time, and I've never seen a situation where people just, have this fantasy of everything kind of working out as they envision it, as they would like it to be, and not facing reality and real obstacles. So I think that's, people want this to happen, so they think it is happening. And now it's finally hitting some people that this is not the case, or that there seems to be, given what we're hearing from the administration, just an inability to confront the real difficulties of moving ahead with this transition in Venezuela. And, the main actor in the problem is the armed forces. And the way to approach that is not by threatening them. And it may get you votes in South Florida, where there's a large Cuban American and Venezuelan diaspora as well is concentrated, and it may bring in some campaign funds, but it's hard to see that it's going to have any beneficial impact on the course of events in Venezuela.
So do you think that the U.S. have either invested too heavily in Guaido, or have they simply hung him out to dry and let him on that they actually can do something when they can't deliver? I mean, having promised a coup and not delivered, his credibility is shot. So who's at fault there? Is this guy just not...
Well, it's hard to know. There's clearly a lot of communication and coordination between Guaido and his team and this administration. I mean, they're very open and frank about that. And I think it's complicated. I think there are certain things that obviously Guaido welcomes U.S. support. The U.S. is a very powerful actor, an influential actor. It's better that the administration support Guaido than support Maduro. That's good. But I don't think they're sort of on the same page in terms of a lot of what's being said here in Washington. That is, that's, like I said, is counterproductive. I don't think Guaido and his team likes the fact that there's this repetition ad nauseum of all options are on the table. And kind of threatening, the military. They know, I think, that that's not practical, but that's the way the U.S., at least this administration, likes to, its preferred approach. So I think that there are, a lot of points of a collaboration, but there are also differences between Guaido and his team and this administration. It's very hard, to manage. I mean, I think Guaido has been very impressive, certainly very courageous. The only opposition figure that I've seen in 20 years of Chavismo in Venezuela who really strikes a chord with many ordinary Venezuelans, and these are not just sort of middle-class traditional opposition people that are going to the streets and are embracing him. He really, his message resonates, and his leadership style, I think, is enormously appealing to the mass of Venezuelans. I mean, a very reliable poll said that if the free elections were held tomorrow, he would get about 80%. If it was him against Maduro, he would get 80%, Maduro about 20%. I think that's right. I think that reflects the sentiment. I think he's a little bit miscalculated and underestimated the resilience of the Maduro regime, and also the armed forces, who I think that he genuinely felt would turn and support him once he brought a lot of people out to the street, and that hasn't materialized. But I think he's a very impressive leader, and he does command broad support in Venezuela. So I don't fault him. I think he's made some mistakes, but he's a 35-year-old political leader that's been thrust on this very complicated situation. And I think on balance, he's done extremely well. But I think the United States would be more helpful in holding its rhetoric in check, letting Guaido take the lead, backing off, supporting Guaido, but not getting out in front with these statements that have more to do with U.S. domestic politics, getting votes in South Florida, or in managing U.S.-Russian relations, which is really not the issue here. And I don't think that's seen very sympathetically by most of the opposition, although they're in a tough position.
But given the conditions in Venezuela where people are starving, you're running out of food and medicine, constant blackouts, there's hyperinflation, there's no security, and there hasn't been for the longest time, from street gangs and violence and criminals. And now you've got the colectivos, the hired thugs from the regime harassing people. And recently there was looting in one of the major cities where the oil patch is. So if you've got such terrible conditions in that country, you could run a cocker spaniel against Maduro and win. I mean, that's not the issue, is it? The issue is, how do you get free and fair elections, since the last election the Maduro pulled off was totally rigged?
And the
only guy that was actually elected in any democratic way is the head of the assembly itself. And Guaido is at the head of the assembly. And because a lot of American leftists say he's a tool of America's right wing and all that stuff. And they somehow think that this Maduro is some kind of hero like Chavez, But my sense is that the likeliest route to get out of this would be somebody coming out of the Chavismo world that is more authentic than this crooked, incompetent bus driver who's driven the country into the ground, whose wife is involved with the drug dealers, etc., and just a bunch of crooks, I mean, I can't understand these idiot leftists. This corrupt capitalism and this corrupt socialism. Corruption is the issue, not the ism.
Right. Well, I think you're right that this is not going to, this dire situation that you described very well is not going to be addressed with Maduro in charge. I mean, he's been in charge for over 6 years, and it's just gotten worse and worse. And whatever he's tried to do hasn't worked. And so the situation is deteriorating at an accelerating rate, both the economic situation, humanitarian situation as well. So I do think, somebody else has to lead the charge. I don't think that the Guaido scenario, the hoped-for scenario, which is that let's take to the streets and the military will fold and back us, hasn't worked. He's tried it 3 times. He tried it in January, he tried it in February on the border with Colombia, and he tried it this week, and it hasn't worked. It may have run its course. I do think that where we're headed is another scenario, which is, you indicated, another leader from Chavismo, and it may be a military official, that Maduro's terms of departure are discussed. He no longer is in control, and the military takes total control. And then, you could have one of two scenarios. You can have a scenario of a military that's, really committed to solving the problems of Venezuela and also committed to a democratic transition that reaches out to Guaido and other opposition leaders and maybe tries to include them in a new government. Or they become a more efficient police state than effective police state, which would be obviously a horrible scenario, but it's one that you can't rule out. As you described very well, there's just massive insecurity in the country, and they could come in and say, we have to get things under control, and Maduro was incompetent, and we're going to be competent, and we're going to rein in all of these violent actors. But that could, that could have a huge cost and be a very, unfortunate scenario. So we don't know. But I think you're right in the sense that this current situation of stalemate and Guaido versus Maduro is not sustainable. I think both of them have been battered and weakened by what's happened. Maduro's weak, Guaido is weakened because his strategy hasn't worked. And I think that maybe where we're headed is for somebody else to take charge And then we'll see what kind of path they decide to pursue.
Well, just in closing, my understanding is that the Trump administration have exaggerated Cuba's influence over Venezuela. And the fact that they're going after Cuba now to punish Venezuela just seems completely insane. But so,
well, I think it's there's a lot of, you know, controversy and dispute about, you know, the Cuban influence. Clearly, Cuba is an ally of Maduro, and that started with Chavez and Fidel, who are very close, and Venezuela still provides lots of oil to Cuba, so it's important for the Cuban economy. It's hard to know. I mean, there are people, you know, I think we know that there's some Cubans involved in sort of counterintelligence and security, but exactly the numbers and the extent, I think, are not entirely clear. I mean, a lot of people who proclaim with great confidence what the nature of the Cuban role is. But again, the fact is, I don't think we really have a very clear sense of the extent of it. But I think to deny that the Cubans are involved, I think, is also to ignore reality. But I think it's ultimately, the shots aren't called in Havana. They're called in Caracas. And I think that's what we have to deal with. But we should be mindful that there are external actors that are playing a role. Cuba, China, Russia, Iran, Turkey. That's just the reality.
Well, Marcus Schiffer, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
My pleasure. Thanks for the invitation.
And again, I've been speaking with Michael Schiffer, who's the President for Policy and Director of the Andean Program at the Inter-American Dialogue and co-editor, along with Jorge Dominguez, of Constructing Democratic Governance in Latin America. He also writes and comments widely on U.S.-Latin American relations and hemispheric affairs, and has regularly testified before Congress about U.S. policy towards Latin America. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into the abdication of Japan's Emperor Akihito and the ascension of his son Emperor Norihito, and whether Japan will go nuclear soon.
Una potra la sana, caballo viejo se encuentra, el pecho se le desgrana y no le hace caso a faceta, y no le obedece a freno ni lo paran pasas riendas.
But the Adams here, in spite of hysteria, it flourishes in Utah as well as Siberia. And whether you're a black, white, red, or brown, the question is this when you boil it down. To be or not to be, that's the question. The answer to it all ain't military Adam, like who gets there firstest with the mostest Adams. No, the people of the world must decide their fate. They got to get together or disintegrate. A whole less truth to be self-evident that all men may be cremated equal.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Graham Fuller, the former vice chairman of the National Intelligence Council at the CIA, who's currently a professor of history at Simon Fraser University. He's lived and worked in the Muslim world for nearly two decades and is the author of numerous books about the Middle East, including Turkey and the Arab Spring, Leadership in the Middle East, and Breaking Faith, a novel of espionage, and An American's Crisis of Conscience in Pakistan. And his latest book is Bear, a novel of eco-violence in the Canadian Northwest. Welcome to Background Briefing, Graham Fuller.
Thank you, Ian.
So in Japan, the Emperor Akihito, he stepped down, abdicated. His son, Naruhito, is now the emperor. He became emperor yesterday. And in his speech, he expressed hope for happiness and world peace, and it does indicate that he is continuing Japan's stance as a pacifist nation ever since it was defeated in World War II by largely the dropping of two atomic bombs. So you've written a very interesting piece, Japanese Nukes on the Horizon. I don't mean to rain on the Emperor's parade, but my understanding is that Japan does have a lot of plutonium, and they may well even have developed plans for a nuclear weapon. And if they decided to go nuclear, they could do it very quickly.
Well, given the general state of high state of Japanese technology in so many fields, it's hard to imagine that they don't fully grasp how they would to put together a nuclear weapon themselves at short notice. Of course, I mean, ideally one would need to test these things, but again, with high technology, you might not even have to be able to do it. But yeah, I think the latent capability is certainly there, and the Japanese would be very remiss if they hadn't long thought of that.
So why do you think they're thinking of it now?
Well, I'm not saying that they're especially thinking of it now. I just think as I look at the logic of the evolution of East Asian politics, it seems almost inevitable to me that this is the way Japan would go. Indeed, to talk about Japan going nuclear right now at this very turning point from in the emperorship is not meant to suggest that this is a tip towards anything more warlike at all. But, I mean, I think in my article, I tried to suggest that this is coming in the context of the U.S. more and more losing control of what was a huge U.S.-dominated global security network. And that's already NATO is weakening, and this is not all due to Trump remotely by any means. I think it's just lots of nations in the world thinking that they're not quite sure really any longer they need to be in lockstep with the U.S. global security vision. They don't want to be tied down to wise or unwise. It's been unwise most of the time, unwise policies with which they might have to be associated. So it's in that sense that I thought of it, writing about this now rather than any change in the emperorship.
Well, I've often thought in terms of the dialogue with North Korea and China being the key player in terms of working some kind of deal between the U.S. and North Korea, which Trump has been trying to do. And Kim Jong-un recently went to Vladivostok and met with Putin, who was on his way to the Belt and Road conference that the Chinese are hosting for their big Belt and Road initiative, which we certainly should talk about. But in general, my sense has always been that both the South Koreans and the Chinese surely have an interest in Japan not going nuclear because North Korea has done so. So was that an issue in terms of China's annoyance with North Korea, that they didn't really want them to go nuclear because they thought at the end of the day it would provoke Japan into going nuclear?
Yeah, I don't. There's a long pedigree on this, and you can go back to the Korean War and the strong Russian role in North Korea some time back. I think really we need to look at this in, or at least to me, it makes more sense in the contemporary situation. First of all, I think we need to be clear what the U.S. why the U.S. is not in favor of a nuclear weapon in Japan. Certainly, I think few people in the world want to see nuclear proliferation because we all fear that perhaps it makes a nuclear war more likely. Whether that's true or not is another issue, but mainly if Japan goes nuclear, it just simply removes Japan's need to be tied to the U.S. for its own security vis-a-vis China in particular, and that would be a major, probably one of the biggest setbacks that could possibly happen to the United States were it to lose its domination of Japanese security policy.
So that, you think, is the real issue? It's really that the nuclear umbrella is there to basically guarantee Japan, and that Japan's what they're not entirely convinced that being under the American nuclear umbrella is helpful. But my understanding is that Abe is a much more militant leader than they've had for some time, and he's trying to revise the pacifist treaty and build up the self-defense forces, as they're called, and certainly spend a lot more money on defense. And there have been these kind of collisions, if you will, over piles of rocks in the South China Sea between that both China and Japan contest. So what's going on? You know, the U.S. Navy is trying to show the flag with these new Chinese man-made islands, etc. Is there just a general sense that the American empire is eclipsing in terms of its military power, even though what we spend more than anybody else than the, I think, the top seven or eight countries combined? So,
right. Well, I think it's just, as I said earlier, a reluctance to for many, many countries, and this goes for Europe as well, to tie themselves to an American global strategic vision, which is increasingly hawkish and very military-oriented, as opposed to, say, even the case of China, which is putting forward economic and political ties linking Asia. I don't want to say that the Chinese don't have ambitions, of course, to be a great power. They are, they are and will be, for sure, the great power of Asia, and there's nothing that the U.S. can ever possibly do about that. It's South China Sea is essentially a Chinese lake, but the U.S. doesn't want to give this up any faster than it has to. So I think that's it's a renegotiation or a reassessment, a rejiggering perhaps of the nature of these security relationships in East Asia. And on top of it, as you point out, Ian, it's not like we have a weak Japan that is otherwise is going to be dominated by China. Japan's economy is still formidable. It's one of the biggest, perhaps the second biggest trading partner of China, heavily investing in China, and a very, very serious so-called self-defense force, which is quite high tech and really very able to defend Japan against all kinds of things. So once it would be an acknowledgement, perhaps, that that Japan is no longer now under anybody else's shadow for its security needs and can stand alone. I don't think there's going to be nuclear war between Japan and China, or even war at all. But if both sides are nuclear, it perhaps lessens the likelihood rather than increases it.
So can you really say that nuclear weapons are defensive? That would be the Japanese rationale, would it not? If they decided they didn't want to be under the U.S. umbrella.
Exactly. It would be self-sufficient and totally independent in their security stance. I mean, it doesn't mean under terrible stress and strain you might not turn to other countries at some moment of crisis and attempt to gain some support. But basically, it means that Japan would want to call the shots in interpreting and setting forth its own interests, strategic interests in the area, rather than having the U.S. tell Japan that, no, you shouldn't deal with Huawei, or no, you should watch out for this, that, or the other thing on China. Japan knows China exceptionally well and doesn't need to be told these things, and they may not want to have to bear the burden of American policies towards China with which, say, Japan might not agree and might find somewhat bellicose and undesirable.
But North Korea, of course, has up to what estimates of 60-plus nuclear weapons. I'm not sure about their delivery systems, but they have tested a lot, fired in Japan's direction and upset the Japanese. Japan has not gone nuclear as a result of North Korea, but how does that particular wild card fit into this scenario?
Well, I think you would agree, Ian, it probably increases the pressure greatly on Japan to develop that capability overtly and explicitly, rather than being hostage to possible nuclear threats or being hostage to the United States, which could trigger or not trigger a war with North Korea, in which Japan might be drawn in against its will and against its better judgment.
So it's a very complicated reawakening, if you will, of complexities.
Well, it is. And we didn't even talk about Russia, which, of course, is a very significant player, and it borders on North Korea, which people tend to forget. And also Russia is in possession of several islands which are contested with the Japanese since World War II. That is also an emotional issue. So Russia is very much in the game, but Russia has all kinds of reasons to want to have good relations with Japan, not least of which is developing Russia's East Asian industry and entire economic zone centered around Vladivostok. So I don't think we're talking about Russia, China, Japan necessarily at daggers drawn and ready to attack each other at all. There are all kinds of good reasons, and especially economic, that push, contribute to these countries, I think, cooperating in quite a number of ways and not wanting the U.S. to be calling the shots or defining the structure of those relationships as it has been doing for a long time.
Well, back to the new emperor, his reign, Rewa, means beautiful harmony. So let's hope that that becomes a fitting description of his reign, even though, of course, he has no successor. He has a daughter, but his brother, who had only had two daughters up until relatively recently, also wasn't going to have a successor. But then he had a third child who's a son. So there, at least right. There is an heir to this ancient throne. So thanks
right.
for joining.
I don't really think in terms of policy change. With the change from one succession of one emperor to the other, so much as a sense that it is the beginning of a new era. Indeed, the Japanese use this term all the time, the era of whatever reign it is.
Right.
And when the era shifts, then perhaps it's time that people start thinking about what a new era might mean. And peace is great. It's very extremely worthy goal. But in terms of Japan's essential forswearing of any military role, and that's what the Article 9 of the Constitution, which was written in at the time of Japanese defeat in World War II, it's hard to say even now that, as we were saying earlier, that Japan is not a country with deep military interests. They just choose not to call it military and maybe won't for a long time. But I don't see the move to nuclear weapons as suddenly moving from a posture of pacifism to a posture of war. But, you know, we all know history, and the Japanese have had a very vigorous and indeed pretty atrocious history in the period between up to World War II in China and Manchuria and Philippines and elsewhere. So if Japan is returning to history in the sense that the China is or Turkey is or Russia is returning to a traditional role in China, neighbors will worry about what that might mean for Japan. But the question of nukes, to me, is not at the heart of what kind of Japan it will be. It will really be Japan's attitude towards the region as a whole.
Well, Graham Fuller, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you, Ian. My pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Graham Fuller, former Vice Chairman of the National Intelligence Council at the CIA, currently a Professor of History at Simon Fraser University. His latest book is Bear, a Novel of Eco-Violence in the Canadian Northwest. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available at backgroundbriefing.org, where we have just made it easier for you to sign up for email updates as well as subscribe wherever you get your podcast. If you like this program, we encourage you to rate and review us on iTunes, Google Play, and SoundCloud. And please do share today's program with friends, family, and colleagues on Twitter and Facebook. We've also made it easier for you to help us sustain our mission, spread the word, and keep us corporate and commercial free by adding a donation button. So if you are in a position to give support, please take a moment and visit backgroundbriefing.org/donate, where your tax-deductible contributions will help us continue to make America think again. Bye for now.
Lady dressed in white with a man she loved.